I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Under pressure from colleges and universities and a lot of tech companies, the Trump administration backed off a plan this week that would have forced international students taking online courses because of the pandemic to be deported or have their visas rejected. Meanwhile, colleges and universities are gearing up for what will be an unusual school year, offering a mix of online and in-person classes, the elimination of sports and other group activities, changes in dorm policies to keep students socially distanced from each other. Now, adding to the confusion and the concern are spikes in the virus in parts of the country driven in part by young people socializing with each other in bars and at parties without masks and without socially distancing. So how can college students be safe and be educated? How can professors and staff do their jobs without risks of contracting the virus? We begin our conversation with Alyssa Nadworny, and she's NPR reporter covering higher education and college access. And Alyssa Nadworny, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And I should say she is joining us by Skype. You can join us as well if you are a college student or perhaps the parent of a college student or a professor or work in some degree on a college or university campus. We want to hear from you. There are several ways you can join our conversation. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Alyssa, help us understand this whole controversy about international students, why the Trump administration backed off their plans for deportation.
Yeah, well, let's go back to just last week, and we'll talk a little bit about what happened with ICE. So they came out with a rule on July 6th, basically saying that if schools were all online because of the pandemic, their international students couldn't stay in the U.S. Their visas wouldn't be valid. And this has actually always been a rule. But back in March, when pretty much every school went virtual, ICE allowed for flexibility for, quote, the duration of the emergency, basically saying they weren't going to enforce this rule. And then, of course, that decision was reversed last week, and it had a lot of schools and students scrambling because essentially what it said was your options are limited. You know, if your school goes totally online or if your course schedule is online, then you basically have the option to transfer or maybe to switch a major so you could get into some of those labs or those in-person classes. This it caught a lot of schools off guard, right? They've been planning all summer for what college is going to look like in the fall. And then here was ICE kind of coming in and saying, well, wait a second, you got to rewrite some of the things that you've been planning. So that's kind of that's the backstory.
So the decision was reversed. So is it business as usual in obviously very unusual climate here? But for international students, are they in a sense safe? Can they stay in the country and take these online classes?
Right. So just yesterday, I believe it was Tuesday. Days are slipping.
It's hard to know. It's called Blur's Day. It's a new word I learned in the last couple of weeks. Yeah, right. Go ahead, Alyssa.
Well, so all eyes were kind of on these lawsuits. A number of universities, states, cities, even some of the big tech companies got in on this lawsuit to fight these ICE rules. And yes, the government rescinded the rules. And so now it kind of goes back to that temporary order from March saying that they're going to be flexible. So yes, it's a big sigh of relief for international students who are in the U.S. currently. This is especially true for sophomores, juniors, seniors, and graduate students. There is still a lot of uncertainty. You know, there's thought that this may not be the end of kind of some of these tighter immigration rules, especially around student visas. And also for incoming freshmen there that are abroad right now, that are international, it's still a windy road with a lot of hurdles because many of the consulate offices where folks would go to apply for their student visa are closed. I spoke to a student in Shanghai who said he thinks his consulate office is going to open probably October. That kind of makes the fall semester shot, really, sure, because he's still got to go in person to get his visa. So,
well, we're going to be speaking with one of those international students a bit later in the hour. Let me talk sort of more broadly about what colleges and universities, and of course, they're all making their own individual decisions. But it's interesting that it looks like most colleges are going to have some in-person classes. Help us understand where things stand, broadly speaking.
That's right. So, We have seen this shift towards the hybrid model, which I think a lot of colleges are doing. That is a combination of in-person and virtual. There's a fair amount of research that shows the spread happens much more strongly in these large lecture classes. You know, they're inside. One study out of Cornell showed that by eliminating those 100-person classes or above, they could strongly reduce the spread in network on campus. So many schools have kind of shifted to what we're calling the hybrid model, which means maybe labs or small classes can happen in person. But a lot of colleges are going to put those big lecture classes online. They're going to be virtual. So that kind of spread. We still got a fair amount of colleges saying they're going to be in person.
Right.
So I don't want to take that away. But this number of colleges that have kind of done the hybrid model, it's going to be a mix of in person and online. That is growing, and we're expecting that to continue to grow over the next month.
Yesterday, we did a show about K through 12 and what schools are going to try to figure out what to do once classes start in the next couple of weeks. And the Trump administration is putting a lot of pressure on schools to open up and have children in the classroom. There was a Trump tweet not so long ago, schools must open in the fall, talking about colleges and universities. How much pressure from the administration itself?
Well, there definitely is pressure. That's a lot of people think that's what the ICE rules were. Even head of Homeland Security said that was behind kind of this push for the new rules on ICE. Yeah, they want colleges and universities to open. They want things to go back to normal. The challenge is we're still in a pandemic, and we're seeing those numbers go up in coronavirus positive cases among the group that's most likely to be on campus in the fall, those young people. We're seeing spread happen at things like frat parties and off-campus bars. And so that's the real challenge amid this kind of push to reopen, is how do you do that when we're seeing it happen right now in our communities, this spread of student age people?
Have colleges, universities, do they have a plan to try to figure out how to enforce things like social distancing and mask wearing?
So almost every campus has come out that's going to have in-person classes. They said, yes, they're going to depend on social distancing and mask wearing. That is pretty universal. The challenge, of course, is how they're going to enforce it and what the wild card, of course, being will students follow it. So what we've seen so far is that schools have asked students to sign contracts or a code of ethics saying that they're going to follow these rules. I think the University of Pennsylvania actually had some language that said, like, you will not party. You will not social. Wow. You gather socially. The students I've talked to are skeptical of that. I mean, we know kind of the brain science of what's happening in developing brains, and they value reward over risk. And it's a pretty awesome reward to hang out with your friends after you've been potentially, staying at home for months. So I think that's going to be the real challenge in the fall is, how do they enforce these policies? And the classroom, I think that we're probably going to see a lot of success, of mask wearing and social distancing in a classroom setting. The challenge is what happens after the class.
Do we know whether students are hankering to come back to campus, or their parents are hankering for their children to get out of the house and go back to their life on campus? Do we have any sense of where people like that are standing on this issue?
I think so. This is kind of the challenge. I think a lot of people, based on student surveys and based on what colleges have done in their own research, a lot of folks want to come back to campus for many reasons. Of course, there's the financial reason that they're paying for a specific thing and they want to get that. I think there's also stronger connectivity, the safe housing for a lot of students. Students rely on universities often for food and housing. We can't overlook that. Colleges also are kind of essential for their communities. They are gathering places. They are, in some places, the heartbeat of a community. So I think, yes, definitely lots of people want to come back. But even the students I talked to who said, we'll do anything to get back on campus, in the same conversation, they say, I don't know, I'm a little nervous. Like, once I'm back in that space that I'm familiar with, that I'm comfortable being social in, I don't know what's going to happen. So there's definitely a mix, but the survey show students want to come back. The question is, can we do that safely?
You mentioned the cost of a college or university, and certainly for a private college, I mean, it's just an astronomical cost. If classes are online or a mix of online and in classes, are parents willing to pay that full freight?
Yeah, that's going to be the big question. I mean, everybody's kind of looking at enrollment data. So that's where students go. I mean, the big question is going to be, are students reconsidering that price tag and maybe going to a community college? You know, if everything is online,
right,
community colleges are often much cheaper, and potentially you could get some of those, especially entry level classes, taken care of by going to a community college, much lower price tag. You know, we are seeing some colleges offer tuition discounts knowing that they're going to be online. That's rare, to be honest, because, you know, schools rely on tuition. Like, they're not really set up to be able to give a discount. And transferring or transitioning to virtual or online, the costs really only go up. It's not like the colleges are saving money. They're still paying faculty. In many cases, they're actually spending more money to kind of purchase those digital platforms or to train up their faculty and staff. So it's not cheaper to transition to virtual, especially these hybrid models. You think they're doing in-person and they're doing online. So I think that, but definitely the money question is going to be a big, big question going into fall. What are families willing to pay? And time will tell.
We talked again, we have talked on this show a lot about the digital divide, again, how it applies mm-hmm. to K through 12. I wonder for college students, you know, obviously most of them don't have the kind of upper middle class income that allows for all those kinds of goodies. How does the digital divide affect college students?
Yeah, this is a real concern to administrators that I've talked to. You know, we had some practice because in March, you know, we transitioned virtually almost every university, every college. And that kind of gave us an indication that, wow, actually a lot of people, yes, are struggling to connect. They're struggling to have the hardware that allows them to do these virtual classes. So that's like the actual laptops. One thing that happened in the spring was that, you know, a lot of these libraries, a lot of campus libraries have laptop loaner programs, you know, so you could come maybe and borrow a laptop and take it back to your dorm room for an assignment or such. I was speaking with the folks who run IT at University of Southern California, and just in that week that they went home back in March, requests for laptop loaners quadrupled. You know, people all of a sudden were relying on that for their classes. And so, you know, that I think is going to be a real concern going into the fall. We saw in the spring and even now in the summer, a lot of community colleges have turned their parking lots into Wi-Fi hotspots. So students can come and drive up and take their classes or file their assignments in the car in a parking lot, getting campus Wi-Fi. So I think, yeah, laptops and the digital connection, getting internet at home is going to be a real concern just going into the fall.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Alyssa Nadworny, and she covers higher education and college access for NPR. We're talking about what to expect as colleges and universities reopen. We also have another guest who'll be joining us in a couple of minutes as well. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about higher ed and the pandemic. And again, we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Particularly want to hear from students and from teachers, from staff who work on college and university campuses. And again, I'm talking with Alyssa Nadworny. She's NPR reporter who covers higher education and college access. And joining us now is Rebecca Given, and she's a professor of labor studies and employment relations at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. She's also vice president of Rutgers American Association of University Professors and American Federation of Teachers. Rebecca Given, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So what are the plans for Rutgers come the new semester?
Rutgers has announced a plan which I would say is on the safer side of what we've seen from many other universities. So Rutgers is going to be almost entirely remote, with an exception for classes for which it's extremely hard to convert to virtual format, and with a pretty high bar for that. So some classes where it might be a practical science lab or something like nursing where you may need something very, very hands-on in order to really get the course content. But everything else will be delivered remotely, and there won't be meetings on campus. There won't be events on campus. The dorms will only be for those who really need them. But most of the education will be delivered remotely.
And was this a contentious issue, or did the stakeholders essentially come to the same conclusion?
I think for the most part, the employees, both faculty and all kinds of other staff, and the administration feel pretty good about the decision that it was really prioritizing health and safety, even though there are, you know, financial and other concerns. And I think, you know, most of our students come from New Jersey. New Jersey was hit extremely hard by the crisis. Most of our students are working class. Many are first generation, and these are communities that were hit really hard, and they understand the acute health issues. It hasn't passed them by. So I think people were pretty relieved to see that health and safety were put first in making that decision. There wasn't a sort of a more risky approach taken. Even though, of course, we're all disappointed. We see so much value in face to face and what we get by being all in the same room together. We really understand the health implications.
And I want to pick up on that. Alyssa, let me get you back in on the conversation. This is, you know, Rutgers University, a big university in New Jersey. Does that sound like what other universities are at least considering or doing?
So we've definitely seen a trend towards that, with mostly online, with some of these just kind of, yeah, exactly as you said, the kind of the most gain from the in-person, like the labs or the really small seminars. I think we're going to see more of this. You know, for a long time over the summer, we've been hearing announcements of, oh, we're going to be in person. And just in the last week or so, we're starting to see kind of a move over towards what Rutgers is doing. The UC state system, the Cal State system, which is 23 universities in California, they've done mostly online with just a few in person. So that's a big system kind of leading the way. But yeah, I think we're going to see more and more schools kind of lean towards what Rutgers has announced.
I just saw a finding from, and this is from the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, that's the faculty union, they conducted a survey, and they found that about 70% of the faculty who teach in the state system were, quote unquote, uneasy about having students return to the campus. And I want to give you, Rebecca, just a chance to weigh in on that, whether that sounds like the professors and staffers that you talk to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what we're seeing is really, you know, it's at least a dual crisis, if not a triple crisis. So you've got the pandemic and the health crisis, but you've got the financial crisis, especially for public universities, which is layered upon, you know, years of underfunding. And then, of course, we've got this racial reckoning. So you've got all these structural inequities piling up on top of each other. And when it comes to returning to campus and being together in person, what we see is that, you know, we've already been in a situation where there was deferred maintenance on buildings, where HVAC systems were not what we would want them to be, where custodial and cleaning staff were really stretched and sweated and overworked, and that was the baseline. So when you have a higher need for better HVAC and more frequent sanitization and less money is available, you can't quite imagine how it would be possible to meet the safety needs of the current situation. And I think those who work in the universities are acutely aware of that.
I wonder, too, about the online learning programs as it applies to higher education. Alyssa, I'll start with you. And again, I keep going back to K-12, but we just did a show on this, and there have been a lot of concerns among parents that they just felt like their children were not getting the education that they knew that they were getting in the classroom. Is that similar, you think, for higher education? Do online classes need to be revamped or at least tweaked?
Well, certainly, I think there is room for improvement. But I think it's worth noting that, you know, especially in the world of higher ed, online ed has been around for a long time. You know, I mean, I think a lot of colleges had actually been starting to invest in some of this virtual and online learning for the last several years. That, you know, some of those colleges are, of course, reaping the benefits of that in this moment. But yes, for sure, there is some retooling and rethinking over the summer as we learn from lessons in March. But I do think that there is a lot more innovation. And you know, some could argue that in some of these cases, online or a flipped classroom at the college level might actually be better for students. You know, there's long been research about how lectures aren't actually the best way to teach, especially with big science classes.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I think there are some people who are kind of seeing this a little silver lining here of like, maybe we should be rethinking how we teach this stuff.
What do you think, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think that for me, what it comes down to is resources. We have a lot of experience with online education at the college level, and we actually know what works and what doesn't work. So just to give one example, best practice for an online class is about 15 or 20 students to a class, and that's whether it's synchronous, you're meeting live together, maybe on video and having conversations, or whether it's asynchronous and everything is done at different times online, but there still can be interactive components like forums. But those classes work, and the best learning outcomes are achieved when there are 15 to 20 students in a class. So if you think about the number of faculty you need to have a 15 to 20 person online class versus having maybe one professor and a large handful of teaching assistants to teach a big, you know, 300 or 700 person lecture, those are really, really different levels of needs, and those faculty all need to be paid. And what we're finding because of the economic challenges is that, you know, faculty are being laid off, full-time faculty, part-time faculty, and we're not going to get high-quality online instruction if we have hundreds of students with one instructor. There are many ways to have very, very high-quality online or remote instruction.
But it sounds like you need more professors. You need more people who can teach this stuff.
You absolutely need more, and what we're seeing is layoffs and trying to somehow do the same amount or more with fewer faculty rather than the same number or really the higher number that might be needed to maintain the quality.
Alyssa, you want to weigh in on that, and then I'll get our third guest to join our conversation. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to pick up something you said earlier, which was kind of, it's worth acknowledging that higher ed in general, especially the public colleges, were kind of already in a precarious financial situation heading into this pandemic. And so a lot of what you're talking about takes resources. And, you know, state budgets are squeezed right now. And often the thing that gets cut when you need to balance that budget is higher ed. And so, you know, here we are in a moment in which to do this really well, we need resources, we need money, and we don't have it.
And that is Alyssa Nadworny. And again, she's NPR reporter. She covers higher education and college access. Rebecca Given as well, and she's professor of labor studies and employment relations at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. She's also vice president of the Rutgers American Association of University Professors and the American Federation of Teachers. We are talking about higher education and the options, the choices as the school year is about to start amid the pandemic. And again, we want to hear from you. Radiotimes at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can send us you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Well, as it turns out, foreign college students will no longer lose their visas if they're taking classes. This was reversing a Trump administration order. And I do want to talk about the impact of that reversal. And joining us is Neha Lashari, and she's an international graduate student at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. She's also a campus political organizer. And Neha, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So what did this reversal mean for you personally?
Gosh, I mean, I think everybody else who's on the show has talked really cogently and seriously about the stressors on students in what is already a very precarious climate of being in the middle of a pandemic amid all the economic issues that come as a result of it. And I think at the very least, for me, this is just one thing off my plate, and it is one very existential thing off my plate. Mm-hmm. So I can't correctly bring across just how much it means to not have to deal with that. Just as I'm staring in the face of another semester that's already going to be full of surprises, and that's already going to be subject to a lot of precariousness.
I'm curious about what if that ban had essentially been put in place and implemented, what were your plans? What were you going to do?
Well, I recently got married to an American citizen, and I'm not an American citizen myself, obviously, which is why I could have been affected. And so for me, it would almost be looking at a potential separation from my husband. And so that is a level of sort of human effect that can't really be explained when you just think about the economic impacts this might have on universities. There are international students in the United States who, like me, have been here for years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would be one thing if international students just sort of robotically began their studies and just left when things, you know, when your program wraps up or when your opportunities wrap up. But so often you find yourself cultivating a world, cultivating relationships. And so, you know, of course, there's a very important economic and educational impact, but just from a human dignity standpoint, it's so difficult to be able to quantify just the kind of threat that such an order might have put for international students.
I'm curious. I know you went to Northeastern University, and now you're at Tufts. What drew you to the United? Why did you want to study in the United States in the first place?
So I grew up in Pakistan, and I grew up in a city in Pakistan that is seen as its heart, its cultural, intellectual heart. And when I was 13, my family moved away from Pakistan. And ever since then, I've been sort of yearning to go to a place that reminds me of my home city. And Boston, in particular, was that as like the sort of intellectual, cultural heart of the United States. And when I first visited here, when I came to look at colleges, I just felt such a familiarity with Boston in particular that I hadn't felt with a city since my childhood, rather.
Just a little colder, I can imagine, though.
Yeah, just a little bit. Which, you know, you get, the human body is resilient. You get
it
used
does,
to almost
yes.
anything. I find myself struggling with the heat now. But it was just it almost felt like a homecoming. And here I am 7 years later, still here, still managing the cold. You know, it's incredible the kinds of things that draw people from all around the world to one singular city in one singular country.
You know, Alyssa, let me get you in, and I'd like to get you in on the conversation, Rebecca, as well. I'm looking at something that the president of MIT had an op-ed in the New York Times this week. He says, I'm the president of MIT. America needs foreign students. I can't do justice to everything that he writes there. But, Alyssa, if you could just speak to the role that foreign students play in our education system.
So there's so many components here. You know, I've been speaking with a number of college presidents and the folks who run kind of their international students on campus. They run the programs for international students, and they just say having international students on American campuses is just essential, even just for culture. I talked to someone from the University of Arkansas who said, you know, we have a lot of students who come from all over the state, rural areas. Sometimes they've never left the state, and coming to the University of Arkansas and meeting people from all over the world is not only a huge draw, but it enriches everyone's learning environment. So we've got kind of that component, which I think is really important. And also you think about kind of just the intellectual prowess, you know, that comes out of universities and graduate programs and PhD programs. Even in this moment, research on the virus and on vaccines, you know, there are contributions felt throughout kind of every system of American higher ed, from undergraduate all the way up to PhD. And I think also, you know, that there is a financial component here that international students, we're not just talking about tuition, but it's also money that is fused into the U.S. economy. You know, that's a big thing. I think one estimate said there were tens of billions of dollars just in 1 year infused into the U.S. economy from international students alone.
Wow. Rebecca, you want to weigh in on this at all?
Yeah, it's absolutely the case that our communities and our universities gain so much from the presence of international students, undergraduates and graduate students. Our graduate students, most of whom, many of whom are also workers as teaching assistants and research assistants, whether they're, you know, working in labs that might be working on, you know, the coronavirus and our fighting of the pandemic, or everything across the institution. You won't find a graduate program at a major university that isn't heavily international in terms of the students studying and working in the program, and it really does benefit everyone, right? So our research, our teaching, everything would absolutely grind to a halt without the work that the international graduate students do. And I think the way the federal policy was sort of framed was as if, you know, studying in an American university was something that benefits the individual international student. And that's just an incorrect way to look at things. What we actually know is that it benefits all of us. It benefits those of us within the universities, but it benefits our whole communities, whether we're talking about the vibrancies of our cities and towns, whether we're talking about, you know, measurable economic or scientific contributions or anything else. It's really something that is beneficial almost any way you look at it, and it would have been really, really catastrophic to cut that off, not to mention sort of immoral and unjust.
Well, I want to take another short break, and Naiha, if you can just stay with us. I have one or two more questions for you before we have to say goodbye to you, but I do want to, in fact, I have to take this break because it's kind of built into the format of the show. We are talking about higher education under the pandemic, what colleges and universities are deciding about online and in-person classes. Also talking about the fact that a policy was basically rescinded this week affecting international students. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. We want to hear from the professors, the university staff, the students, the parents, who all are involved in higher education. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ray.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Go Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests about what's going to happen with higher education in the next couple of weeks as colleges and universities open, whether open their doors literally or online. And again, Alyssa Nadworny, our guest, NPR reporter, covers higher education and college access. Rebecca Given, professor of labor studies and employment relations at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University, also vice president of Rutgers American Association of University Professors and American Federation of Teachers. And Neha Lashari, a graduate student, an international graduate student at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Neha, just one or two questions before we have to say goodbye to you. First of all, what are you studying and what do you hope to do with your degree?
So I'm lucky enough to be at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, studying both law and diplomacy. I focus on international law with a concentration on human rights and international justice. I hope to work in international law, hopefully go to law school after this, because I guess after 7 years, I'm still not done with school.
Oh, my goodness.
and hopefully sort of, as cliche as it sounds, genuinely help make the world a better place by working on creating more robust mechanisms for accountability in international justice and conflict resolution. My school is 40% international students, and wow, we create gators of diplomats. So you can imagine how having such a sort of integrated student body with both American students and international students, how positively it reflects on international relations if you have diplomats who know each other from school and who know each other from all walks of life representing their disparate countries.
Do you see yourself living in the United States, or are you open to living in other parts of the world?
I'm open to living in other parts of the world. I mean, I, as much as I love Boston, in the field I'm in, I'm not sure necessarily that staying in Boston is going to help me help people in the best way possible. I'm lucky enough to have a husband who is invested in my own career goals and is willing to go everywhere with me or anywhere with me even. I'm uniquely lucky that I've been able to stay here for as long as I have and really see myself as part of the fabric of American society, despite the fact that I wasn't born here, I wasn't raised here. And so it was a real moment of reckoning for me, realizing just how quickly how quickly you can go from being an asset to a liability. It was a really difficult moment, but I'm glad that for now we seem to be past it.
I'm glad as well, and I really appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, and good luck to you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Neha Lashari, again, graduate student at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Let me go back to you, Alyssa. You said earlier in the hour that while this particular controversy has been settled, things are not necessarily going to, I guess, protect international students going forward. Help us understand, I guess, what's at issue or what's at stake?
Well, you know, so the universities that I've talked to are basically planning just in case something like this happens again. You know, they just don't want to get caught off guard. And especially with this administration, it can be, you know, it's uncertain kind of what immigration plans are coming down. President Trump has said that he has a plan, that he has something in the works on immigration. So I think that's made kind of some international students and certainly colleges stand at the ready. There is also this big challenge for incoming freshmen. You know, some research has shown that the enrollment for incoming freshmen for this fall may be down as high as 68%.
Wow. And that's
just due to the fact that we're in a pandemic and there are travel restrictions. You know, as I said earlier, consulate offices are closed. Visas may be challenging to get. For students coming from China, you know, they may have to quarantine in a third country before they can even enter the U.S. So there's still lots of hurdles ahead for many international students.
Let me get Richard from Tresher to join our conversation. And Richard, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Okay. What I wanted to point out is that when a foreign student comes to the United States, is sitting in our classroom, normally they're paying the full freight. I mean, they're paying full amount for tuition and whatnot, and quite often it's paid for by their government. So in effect, we are exporting education to that country. Now, for example, I used to teach in San Antonio in a junior college there, and I had a lot of Saudi students, and for that matter, Chinese students, and the Saudi government was paying their tuition. So in effect, we were exporting education to Saudi Arabia, and of course that helps our balance of payments.
Are you saying that's a good thing or a bad thing or a neutral thing?
That's a good thing because it helps our balance of payments. Whenever we export something, that helps our country, that increases our GDP. And, you know, I think any economist will tell you this. So it helps our economy a lot in kind of a general way, for a foreign student to come to the United States so that, again, we're exporting something. It's not like we're exporting a car, but we are exporting education, and, of course, that helps our balance of payments.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Richard, thanks so much. Rebecca, let me go back to you and sort of look into our crystal balls, as cloudy as they are. And obviously the pandemic is here for now. We don't know how long it's going to stay or how much colleges and universities are going to have to really rework how they do education and lots of campus activities. What are some of the things out of this pandemic you think that could improve education?
I think one of the things that the pandemic is forcing us to do is really understand or, you know, think about how we return to our core values, right? So whether changes are being made direct because of the direct health challenges or because of the financial crisis that we're now in, we're having to make really hard decisions. And some of those decisions, like all budgetary decisions, reveal a lot about ourselves, right? So are we making decisions that protect the most vulnerable, whether those are vulnerable campus workers who are being laid off or vulnerable students who might not have a safe place to log on to an online class from home or might not have high-speed internet, right? And I think, you know, when we think about cuts and we think about new budgets, what are our priorities? Do we care about access and equity? Do we care about the quality of learning, or do we just care about extracting the most tuition from the largest number of people, right? And so I think that there's really this reckoning. It's often easy or you know, somehow just done without thinking to cut the kinds of programs that supposedly we've said we believe in, and then all of a sudden ethnic studies are cut, or support services for students who are already structurally disadvantaged are cut. So when we decide we're still going to be spending money on some things, what things will we still spend money on? Will we spend money on diversity initiatives? Will we make sure that we retain our lowest paid, most vulnerable workers? Or will we look at some of the administrative bloat, or, you know, some of the salaries for coaches of sports that aren't currently being paid, or the size of coaching staffs, right? So what values do we want to move forward with? Just because our budgets are shrinking doesn't mean that we don't get to shape the new budgets and think about how we prioritize. And I think, you know, at this time, especially with the Black Lives Matter reckoning that we've had, there have been a lot of really powerful statements. And when we make financial and resource decisions, we'll see what was really behind those statements.
Well, let me toss that to you, Alyssa. When you look, again, broadly speaking, at the budgets for colleges, universities, are there places of obvious bloat?
You know, that's a challenging question here, and it's going to vary from institution to institution, right? Because the thing about higher ed is it includes so many different kinds of colleges. You know, we've got community colleges and state colleges, small liberal arts colleges, large private schools, and every institution's finances look a little bit different.
Sure.
And so that's a challenge. You know, I think they're all being squeezed. I think I hear a lot of kind of in the conversation about, oh, what about endowments? And I think people kind of misunderstand what endowments are. Only about 120 institutions have these kind of big endowments that we all talk about. So that's not really an option. You know, but in terms of kind of what to cut and what to keep, I think absolutely along the points we just heard from is like, what do we value? And kind of these commitments to help folks graduate over time. You know, we still have so many students who enroll in college and don't finish. That, of course, was an issue before the pandemic. It's going to be a major issue going forward. So I think things like student support services, student affairs, efforts to help people complete college, to get those degrees, that's going to be really important going forward. And we're going to see, yeah, exactly, as we come to balance these budgets and to figure out what to cut, what institutions really value. That was really well said.
I'm curious, and if I can toss this back to you, Alyssa, but also to you, Rebecca, as well, about, let's say a college university opens their campus, a certain number of students do return, someone gets sick from COVID-19, you know, what the options are. Are there liability issues, Alyssa, that colleges and universities face? Help us understand that.
Yeah. Well, so this is a big question going into the fall. I'm going to take it in a couple different pieces. The first is there a plan for what to do when there's positive cases? We know how much community spread is going on in the United States right now. There will be positive cases on campus when they reopen. And so that is a big, big question, is kind of what's the plan for if it happens? And colleges haven't been super clear about that. Like, at what point will they switch to all virtual? At what point will they shut down? You know, we have heard plans for if there are positive cases, in the sense that they will They're going to thin out dorms so they have room to quarantine, to self-isolate those folks who test positive. But yeah, that's a big question of kind of like what is going to happen if there's an outbreak. In terms of the liability question, which is a big one and on a lot of colleges' minds, we have seen some signaling from Congress that liability waivers may be in the works for the next kind of relief package. But, you know, still big question mark on that one.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Rebecca? And I'm wondering whether professors, I'm thinking of classroom professors, whether they can say no to if they are what, forced to teach in-person classes. Are there issues there?
Yeah, there's a lot there. So there were a group of universities that were, I guess, caught. It was leaked that they were lobbying for these liability waivers. And I would say I think it was a bit embarrassing for them to be shown to be sort of fighting for the ability to make potentially unsafe decisions without consequences. What we're seeing is universities handling it really differently, those that are doing a combination of in-person and online, where some are basically saying it's at the choice of the instructor. So if the instructor wants to only teach online, no questions asked, they can do that. And some are holding up a really high bar, making it, you know, basically an ADA standard. So you really have to show that this is a legally required accommodation, which is very difficult because the ADA only applies to the employee. So if you say, I prefer not to teach in person because I have a family member with health vulnerabilities, that may not be approved, right? And so what we're actually seeing is a huge variation. And on some campuses, faculty are sort of getting together to write back, to fight back and say this is actually unacceptable, and we're gonna speak up and say you should not be forcing people to do face-to-face instruction. If people want to opt into face-to-face and they feel that the safety and social distancing measures are adequate, then they can, but they should be able to opt out, no questions asked. But we are seeing some campuses where that does not yet at least seem to be the case, and there's a lot of questions that remain, including liability, including eligibility for workers' comp. There's all kinds of questions that come out of that.
Let me squeeze one more caller, and this is Philip from Brewery Town. And Philip, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Almost out of time here, Philip, but go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment on that. This latest move by the Trump administration seems to be blatant xenophobia. And just going back to his then speech, the infamous Escalade speech, where he was referring to immigrants as rapists, as murderers, and some assume were good people. This is a move against those quote-unquote good people that he has been using constantly as an excuse for strengthening immigration policies. And this is also just a move by this administration continuing going back to isolationism, that they think that we need to be a country completely isolated from the rest of the world. And why is there such an insistence by this administration that we do better as isolationists, even though time and time again is proven that is not the way we should be going?
And you know that policy was reversed, just so you know that, Philip.
I do know that policy was reversed, but it's just the action, the fact that this was even a debate.
I hear you. Alyssa, do you want to weigh in on this at all? We're almost out of time,
well,
but give you a chance.
Yeah, I'll just say, you know, it was a unified, significant, immediate legal action against kind of this move. I think that's worth noting that colleges across the country just came together, and many, many lawsuits were seen within a few days. So I think that just shows kind of the power of the university in this moment.
So, Rebecca, we're almost out of time, but what are your plans then for the fall, and when does Rutgers open?
Rutgers will reopen right around the 1st of September, and reopening will be mostly remote. But, you know, those of us who work in the university, whether faculty, whether staff, whether custodians, are committed to, you know, protecting the most vulnerable, providing high-quality instruction that serves the students that we always serve, which is, you know, the students of the state of New Jersey. And, you know, we'll be as flexible as we can. We'll be very, very mindful of health and safety, both of ourselves, those that work at Rutgers, but of our students and of our surrounding communities. And we're learning as we're going, and we're just asking the administration to prioritize our well-being, our health and safety, and not to take out the deepest cuts on those who are already hurting the most.
Well, we have to leave it there. Rebecca Given, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. She's a professor of labor studies and employment relations at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. Alyssa Nadworny, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I should say to our listeners, we called you up just a couple minutes before we went on the air to have you on the show, but I really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for us as well. And again, NPR reporter covering higher education and college access. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.